Welcome. You are listening to AfterSight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Good day, Colorado, and thank you for joining us for the May 1st reading of The Environment. My name is John. Hard to believe it's May 1st already. Today we've got the following main articles from the Sierra Club magazine, The Environmental Victories Keep On Coming, a cheat sheet for tracking the flood of good news from the Biden administration, written by Allison Harford. Also, a housing crisis is impacting the National Park Service. NPS leadership is well aware of the problem, but Congress will not fund solutions, written by Molly McCluskey. With any time remaining, we'll pick up an article from Nature Conservancy or Mother Earth News. First article, The Environmental Victories Keep On Coming, written by Allison Harford. The Biden administration is on a roll when it comes to putting in place strong standards to protect our wilds, safeguard clean water, and tackle the climate crisis. In the last couple of months, federal agencies have issued a flood of new rules to bolster renewable energy and conserve natural landscapes. Taken together, the raft of administration actions represents a truly historic, unprecedented presidential commitment to environmental protection. Melinda Pierce, legislative director for the Sierra Club, says that Biden has the most ambitious climate and environmental agenda of any president in history. All of this in the lead-up to Earth Day has been breathtaking, says Pierce, referring to the federal announcements that have occurred in just the last week. He's making good on all his government approach to tackling climate and environment. It really does span the spectrum of conservation protections, clean energy, and environmental justice. So many ambitious environmental actions have been announced in March and April that it can be dizzying to keep track of them all. Here, then, is a cheat sheet to track all these environmental victories. Strong new rules for dirty power plants. Coal and gas-fired power plants are one of the largest sources of climate-destabilizing pollution in the world, according to Vicki Patton, General Counsel for the Environmental Defense Fund. Under new rules announced by the EPA on April 25th, new gas-fired power plants and existing coal-fired power plants will have to capture at least 90% of their smokestack carbon dioxide emissions by 2039 or shut down entirely. The pollution rules, four in total, also create new standards for mercury emissions from smokestacks, waste dumps of coal ash, and wastewater discharges. When fully implemented, the new standards will dramatically reduce greenhouse gas emissions and put President Biden's goal to eliminate carbon pollution from the electricity sector by 2035 within reach. The EPA estimates that the new rulings could reduce carbon emissions by 1.38 billion tons through 2047. This is the first time the federal government has ever restricted carbon dioxide emissions from existing coal-fired power plants. According to the Sierra Club's Beyond Coal campaign, there are 148 remaining coal plants in the United States and 382 retired. Any coal-fired power plants that announce their retirement before 2032 will not be subject to the new rules. It is a major step forward in our movement's fight to decarbonize the electric sector and help avoid the worst impacts of climate change, Sierra Club Executive Director Ben Jealous said in a statement. Added protections for wildlands in Alaska. At roughly 23 million acres, the unfortunately named National Petroleum Reserve, Alaska, NPRA, is the largest area of intact public land in the United States. These wildlands are essential for indigenous communities and wildlife, but they've also been threatened by oil and gas companies. In 2019, 1.5 million acres were leased to oil companies when the Bureau of Land Management undercut protections for designated special areas. In late April, the Biden administration announced it would ban drilling on 13 million acres in the reserve. It is critical and urgent that Alaska transitions away from fossil fuels and embraces a sustainable energy future. Chantal de Alcuaz, co-executive director of the Alaska Center, said in a statement, These new protections from the Biden-Harris administration and their commitment to addressing the climate crisis are an opportunity for Alaskans to embrace the economy of the future and sustain our Alaskan way of life. The National Petroleum Reserve, Alaska, protections came in tandem with another important conservation decision. The Department of the Interior denied a permit for Ambler Road, a proposed 211-mile-long mining access road that would cross through the gates of the Arctic National Park. A new ethic for public lands management. The Interior Department finalized its public lands rule for areas stewarded by the Bureau of Land Management. The BLM oversees roughly a tenth of the nation's landmass, some 245 million acres, and historically the agency has prioritized mining, cattle ranching, and oil and gas drilling, with recreation and conservation often being a secondary priority. The new public lands rule changes that prioritization by establishing conservation as an equal value use on par with extractive uses. The rule defines a new use. Now, the BLM can auction off restoration and mitigation leases, which can be used to restore and conserve public lands. This is a big deal. This rule amounts to a generation-defining shift in how we manage our shared natural resources, Jamie Williams, president of the Wilderness Society, said in a statement when the rules were announced. Bureau of Land Management lands make up the biggest stretch of the federal estate, and now the Biden administration is putting it on the books officially that they will no longer be neglected or treated as just a source of oil and coal. Oil and gas companies have to pay their fair share for drilling on public lands. More than 10% of all oil and gas produced in the United States comes from public lands. But for decades, the fossil fuel companies have enjoyed below market rates when extracting resources from these lands that are held in common. Oil and gas companies are required to purchase bonds when they lease federal lands to ensure that cleanup takes place. But the cost of those bonds had not increased since 1960, when the price was set at $10,000 per lease, roughly worth $105,000 today. On April 12th, the Biden administration finalized a rule that will increase the bond price to $150,000 per lease and will require fossil fuel companies to pay 16.67% in revenue royalties, up from 12.5%. In addition to increasing funds for restoring lands left behind by fossil fuel companies, the rule will prevent companies from overleasing land, according to NRDC. Nearly 27 million acres of land in the western U.S. was leased in 2020, but less than half of that was actually used to produce oil and gas. The new rule will also raise the price from minimum bids to $10 per acre from just $2 per acre. Conservation organizations were thrilled by this move. The reforms in the final oil and gas rule are common sense and long overdue, Rachel Hamby, policy director at the Center for Western Priorities, said in a statement. Updating royalty, rental, and bonding rates, and ensuring those rates don't fall out of date again in the future, ensures a fair return for taxpayers and is the fiscally responsible thing to do. Drinking water will have fewer PFAS chemicals. The EPA announced the nation's first drinking water standard for PFAS, aka per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances, often referred to as forever chemicals. The chemicals are found in products like food packaging, nonstick pans, and water-resistant clothing. Exposure to PFAS has been linked to harmful health effects, like an increased risk of certain types of cancer. In 2023, a United States Geological Survey study estimated that certain types of PFAS contaminants can be found in nearly half the nation's tap water. The new standard will limit certain types of the chemicals to 4 parts per trillion or less in drinking water. The rule also comes with billions of dollars in funding for states and territories to implement PFAS testing and treatment. The EPA estimates that updated standards can help to protect 100 million people from PFAS exposure. Today's announcement of robust health protective legal limits on PFAS in tap water will finally give tens of millions of Americans the protection they should have had decades ago. Ken Cook, president of the Environmental Working Group, said in a statement when the rules were announced. Billions of dollars for clean energy technology funding. The Biden administration has allocated billions of dollars for clean technology funding. In late April, President Biden announced a combined $7 billion in grants going to 60 organizations as part of the Solar for All program, which will bring solar energy to an estimated 900,000 low-income households. In early April, Vice President Kamala Harris and EPA Administrator Michael Reagan announced $20 billion in funding through the Greenhouse Gas Reduction Fund. That money is going toward three national clean financing institutions and five nonprofit organizations. And another $2.3 billion was announced in March to go towards 39 energy infrastructure and renewable energy projects in rural areas. That comes on top of $366 million announced in February for clean energy projects, mostly within tribal nations. That's a total of nearly $30 billion for clean energy technologies. Administration opens hiring for the American Climate Corps. In 2023, President Biden announced the American Climate Corps, modeled after FDR's famous Civilian Conservation Corps. Applications are now open for 273 initial positions. The White House hopes to eventually employ more than 20,000 young people in climate and clean energy jobs. You'll get paid to fight climate change, learning how to install those solar panels, fight wildfires, rebuild wetlands, weatherize homes, and so much more, President Biden said at a press conference in Northern Virginia. Opportunities are available through organizations including federal agencies, state, local, and tribal governments, nonprofits, and state-based climate corps. Crackdown on methane pollution. The Biden administration has been working on reducing methane pollution created by fossil fuel companies since the passage of the Inflation Reduction Act, which requires oil and gas companies to pay a fee for each metric ton of methane they emit. Methane is an extremely powerful greenhouse gas that is 80 times more heat-trapping than carbon dioxide over a 20-year time period. The EPA first announced pollution rules at last year's United Nations Climate Change Conference. The rule, finalized on March 27, set a ceiling for methane emissions and requires that companies with leases to extract oil and gas on federal lands pay royalties when they exceed the ceiling. The rule aims to reduce negligent methane leaks and discourage venting and flaring. It will also, according to the Interior Department, generate $50 million per year in additional royalty payments to the federal government. Stronger tailpipe standards for cars and trucks. On March 20th, the EPA announced a rule that will clean up tailpipe pollution from new cars and trucks, and in the process will incentivize automakers to sell more electric vehicles. By model year 2027, all new vehicles will have to reduce their carbon pollution. The EPA expects that by 2032, more than half of all car sales will be electric vehicles and estimates that by 2055, the new regulations will reduce carbon pollution by over 7 billion metric tons. On March 29th, the Environmental Protection Agency followed up with another rule setting pollution standards for heavy-duty vehicles like long-haul trucks, buses, and garbage trucks. These standards will help to move the needle on electrifying our biggest, dirtiest vehicles, Ben Jealous said in a statement. Today's next main article, also from the magazine of the Sierra Club, a housing crisis is impacting the National Park Service. National Park Service leadership is well aware of the problem, but Congress will not fund solutions. This article was written by Molly McCluskey. When National Park Ranger Jonathan Jarvis moved into government housing at Oregon's Crater Lake National Park in 1982, he arrived to find that there had been so little maintenance on all the houses for so many years that his new home had been essentially a hardware store for the others, stripped of all hinges, doorknobs, and window mechanisms. The house was basically semi-functional, said Jarvis, who spent his career with the National Park Service, including as the agency's director under President Obama. Recalled in an interview with Sierra, the mover looked around and said, "It's all still on the truck. You don't have to offload." 40 years later, rangers at parks throughout the country tell similar stories of park housing nightmares. National Park Service supplied units are aging and badly in need of repair. And National Park Service staff who look outside their parks for housing in gateway towns are finding that homes, once available for rent, are now being used as nightly vacation rentals. A boom in remote work since the pandemic has further driven up the cost of housing near parks while limiting the overall availability of housing stock. The resulting housing crunch is making it more difficult for parks to recruit and retain the staff they need, warned park superintendents who manage sites across the United States. Every year in the last 5 years, permanent and seasonal staff have declined jobs due to the lack of housing near North Cascades, Donald Stryker, the superintendent of North Cascades National Park, told Sierra. In a typical year, North Cascades needs housing in the Skagit District, west side of the park, for approximately 50 staff. Most housing rentals are annual, which poses difficulties due to the short 5 to 6 month season. The overall housing challenge is availability, cost, and distance from the park. This is particularly challenging for our seasonal employees. The National Park Service has 425 units, covering 85 million acres across the country and in U.S. territories. Park units include everything from scenic rivers to national trails, Civil War battlefields, and other historic sites, and the National Mall in Washington, D.C. Whether they are stationed in sprawling, remote areas or within densely populated cities, National Park Service employees need an affordable place to live. The National Park Service offers its staff housing at more than 200 of its sites. Some 20,000 employees, not including interns, volunteers, and concessionaires, make their homes in the 5,600 units available. The type and condition of the housing varies widely. Officially, they range from 100-year-old cabins to modern dormitories and duplexes. Unofficially, housing units have over the years included metal shipping containers, tents, and historic Army barracks. The average age of a housing unit in the National Park Service is 62 years. Many were built as part of Mission 66, an effort in the 1950s and 60s to celebrate the 50th anniversary of the Park Service by modernizing infrastructure to meet growing visitation. Visitation increased from 17 million in 1940 to 56 million in 1956, and last year, 325 million people visited these parks. With big parks, whether it's a lot of classics like the Grand Canyon or Arches or Zion or Craters of the Moon or Mount Rainier, they all have Mission 66 houses, Jarvis said. Since then, the housing program in the Park Service has been fits and starts, in part because housing is a component of the infrastructure of a park and the priorities for maintenance investment, which is significantly backlogged, have been life, health, safety, obviously visitors first, and right down at the bottom is housing. So not only was there a lack of investment in the existing inventory, but a significant lack of investment in new housing for employees, Jarvis continued. What you're left with is an inventory of substandard housing, most of it in pretty bad shape, with a few exceptions. Kevin Schneider, the superintendent of Acadia National Park, oversees government housing units at both ends of the national park spectrum. His job involves managing both Acadia, one of the country's most visited national parks, approximately 4 million visitors per year, and St. Croix Island International Historic Site, one of the country's least visited, approximately 12,000. Housing is critical for us to be able to offer to our employees at Acadia National Park. We want to hire about 150 to 175 summer seasonals, and we only have about 85 beds in our housing inventory, Schneider said. The nature of the rental market here, for a six-month lease, there is no rental market, especially in the summer season. This is in addition to Acadia's approximately 100 year-round employees who have also struggled to find affordable housing within a commuting distance to the park. St. Croix, with its 3 year-round employees and handful of seasonals, does not face the same housing challenges. At Acadia, like many other parks, two categories of employees receive the highest priority for housing: essential, permanent staff who need to be available to quickly respond to emergencies in the park, like law enforcement and maintenance, and seasonal employees whose low hourly pay and temporary employment preclude them from finding and affording rentals outside of the park. We do not have permanent employees in our park housing, with the exception of when they first move here. Maybe they land in park housing for 3 months while they look for a permanent place to live, Schneider said. But we see a moment in the future here, as at the cost of real estate has risen dramatically, either to purchase or rent, where our permanent employees are having a very difficult time finding available and affordable housing, and we're starting to plan for that as well. In Skagway, Alaska, Klondike Gold Rush National Historic Park faces a set of housing and staffing issues unique to Alaska. Skagway is a small, remote town, accessed only by propeller plane, ferry, or the Alaskan Highway. Set in a confined, narrow valley with a booming seasonal economy, fed in large part by the cruise ship industry, Skagway has always had limited housing options, little room for expansion, and no viable daily commuting options. Building brings additional costs and challenges than in the lower 48. Many of Klondike's seasonal park housing units require double occupancy per room. Several current and former officials at the park told Sierra that potential seasonal employees turn down positions each year because of a lack of suitable housing, including for the 2023 season. However, according to Superintendent Angela Wetz, additions to park housing in the past several years created enough units to meet the needs of the seasonal employees the park will have to hire this year. Seasonal housing is not limited by housing availability in the 2024 season, Wetz said. The number of applicants has been reduced over time post-pandemic, and we are facing staff shortages for a variety of reasons unrelated to housing. Those staff shortages include multiple vacant full-time division chief level positions and specialist positions, including the park's administrative officer, chief of interpretation, museum tech, natural resources specialist, and more. Those year-round positions were previously filled by people who lived in non-park housing. We have a variety of permanent positions we have had difficulty filling, and looking at housing options to help with that shortage is something we are considering options to address, Wetz said. Several current and former staff members blame the vacancies on a morale issue in the park, one directly tied to housing. In 2019, a house previously purchased to accommodate up to six seasonal employees instead became the superintendent's home. National park leadership is well aware of how the housing challenges are impacting staffers, park units, and the agency as a whole. Subpar and limited housing options in or near parks has been hindering the NPS's ability to attract and retain staff, Kathy Cupper, a spokesperson for the National Park Service in Washington, told Sierra. Quality housing that is available for our workforce is a critical issue that requires immediate and ongoing attention and remains a priority. Housing affects many aspects of our operations and directly impacts our employees. The best way to address the situation, park superintendents and conservation organizations agree, is for Congress to increase the funding for park ranger housing. In 2023, Congress funded a housing improvement program for the National Park Service at $7.8 million, enough to repair 75 units. But the Senate and House Appropriations Committee draft budgets for fiscal year 2024 call for a $150 million cut from the National Park Service's budget, a $25 million cut to smaller scale parks, and a $46 million cut to larger park repair projects. This, even as the National Park Service continues to add units to its management, like the new River Gorge National Park in 2020. President Biden's National Park Service budget proposal, submitted to Congress last month, requested a total of $3.57 billion, with more than $100 million earmarked for housing for National Park Service employees across multiple fund sources. The National Park Foundation recently received an anonymous $40 million donation to expand and improve housing at Yellowstone National Park and is expected to fund 70 new modular units. There is no single solution to magically fix the National Park Service's housing shortage. Building new housing without a plan for ongoing maintenance will only increase the burden of the maintenance backlog. Funding alone won't build or repair houses. The staff needed to do both, as well as clean the visitor centers, lead walks and talks, protect cultural and natural resources, and more, can't do any of these things without first finding a place to live. What we're heading toward is what you see in a lot of other countries, what we call paper parks, Jarvis said. They're parks on paper only, because they are understaffed, unmanned, unprotected. Visitors come and go, and things happen, and parks degrade over time. And that wraps up our time for the May 1st reading of the Colorado Sun. Thank you so much for joining us. My name is John.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.